Today we remember Palestinian poet Taha Mohammed Ali, who died this week. I featured his poetry in 2009 when a biography of him was published called My Happiness Bears No Relation to Happiness. The title comes from one of Ali's poems, Warning. If his name is not familiar to you, you're not alone. Born in 1931, he didn't begin to write poetry until he was in his 40s. He got only a few years of formal education and ran a souvenir shop in Nazareth. He and his family had to flee their village in 1948 when it was destroyed by the Israelis. Adina Hoffman writes that many of his poems deal with that loss through a, quote, generosity of feeling and unlikely exuberance. Hoffman and her husband, Peter Cole, who's a poet and translator, live in Jerusalem. I spoke with both of them in 2009 about Ali and their book. You know, I have to say that the title of this book, I just kept turning it over and over and over. I mean, it comes from one of his poems. On the one hand, it's playful, and on the other hand, it seems so filled with sadness on top of that.
That's exactly it. I think you've sort of nailed it. There's a way in which it does contain for me all of this exuberance that you mention. And, you know, Taha is someone who's just incredibly alive and open to the whole world. But, of course, much of that openness and aliveness is shot through with a deep melancholy. It's a complicated happiness. It is happiness. Right. Yeah, absolutely. That's why I chose the title.
Well, and we're talking about this on the radio. There are also, looks like, 9 photographs, small photographs of him on the cover of the book with these various expressions, and he has the most wonderful face, and I wonder if you could describe that face for our listeners.
Oh, boy. Right. Okay. Can
As
I describe
his face? As if
it were
carved in a way.
Yeah. No, Taha, well, one of the interesting things for me as biographer was actually to look at some of the pictures of Taha as a young man, because I was very startled to see how smooth his brow was and how these lines that one sees. I mean, Taha has this incredible, how shall I describe it, a kind of incredibly spidery set of not just an old man's wrinkles on his brow, but you really sort of feel these kind of deep, deep furrows as having been, you know, a deeply lived experience. You know, one doesn't want to, you know, at some level, you don't want to project too much into them, and he actually has various medical conditions that have caused his face to change in certain ways. But there is a kind of incredible he's got one of the most compelling. I keep describing him as he has one of the best faces since the face of the elderly Auden, W.H., one of the great poets' faces since the elderly W.H. Auden. There's something at once almost sort of ghoulish, I suppose you could say, about his face. Somebody who met him and who I quote in the book describes him as being almost like a figure out of a George Gross painting, which is accurate in a way, but there is a kind of intense aliveness. Right. Again, I wouldn't say beauty exactly, but I'm having to think on my feet here.
No, I think you're doing a great job. And I spent so much time looking at the title of this book and looking at his face even before I opened it. Yeah. And actually, Peter Cole is here to read some of Taha Muhammad Ali's poems. And I'd love to have you, Peter, actually read the poem from which this title is taken.
Warning. Lovers of hunting and beginners seeking your prey, don't aim your rifles at my happiness, which isn't worth the price of the bullet you'd waste on it. What seems to you so nimble and fine, like a fawn, and flees every which way like a partridge, isn't happiness. Trust me. My happiness bears no relation to happiness.
And again, I mean, a beautiful poem. Yeah. And Adina, you chose that for the title of your book.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that Taha often says about his own poetry is when he's asked, you know, why doesn't your poetry take on some of these big political issues in a more direct way, maybe even a confrontational way? And Taha says, no. For me, my poetry functions as a kind of billiards, you know, a pool game. And here we're on the radio, so I can't demonstrate. But he basically says, you know, you aim to the left to get to the right. And to me, the title functions in a similar way. There's a sort of indirection. I mean, I think it's clear to anyone who's paying attention that there is all, you know, all those things that you described are in there. But there is this kind of sly, off to the sort of slightly crooked angle of approach.
Well, and the idea of, and I think, I mean, people know what billiards is, but the idea of aiming one way, but sort of having things boomerang and over another way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, he does have this souvenir shop, right?
He does, indeed.
In Nazareth.
Yeah, he is somebody. Taha has worked for his entire life, not just his entire adult life, but his entire life. He basically began, he went into business at age 10. His family was quite poor. His father had polio and couldn't work, so that Taha really felt himself as the oldest son, that this, it was his responsibility to support his family. So he began by buying eggs from the local women in his village and selling them at a slight markup. And then this evolved into a little kiosk where he sold chocolate bars and pencils to the neighborhood kids. And this turned into a grocery store, which was a kind of lean-to at the edge of his family's courtyard in the village. And it was a booming business. He was doing quite well, supporting his family, not exactly in style, but they had meat to eat, which was a big deal, and his mother could buy herself new dresses. And
he was a young boy.
He was a young boy. And this was, he was basically from the age of 10 till the age of 17, he was doing this. And he would have, I think it's safe to say, gone on to become an even more prosperous businessman. He had plans to build himself a whole shop with apartments on top for his brothers and himself and their eventual wives. But in 1948, that all ended. But what's amazing to me about Taha as a businessman is that he never stopped. Even there were 9 months that his family spent in exile in Lebanon. They basically had to leave and were forced to go. His brother Amin described how they had the war at their backs. So they basically just went wherever they could go, and they ended up in Lebanon. And Taha, within days, again started selling things. And this was not. It was almost a kind of instinct. This was how he supported his family and what he needed to do. And so it was a very modest kind of business. He was buying and selling, you know, combs and needles and thread he bought from a local wholesaler and sold to the refugees. But since then, I mean, since he came back to what had been Palestine and was now Israel, he became a shopkeeper. And he's had this souvenir shop. Right now it's next to the Church of the Annunciation. It's, I think it's safe to say, the most successful souvenir shop in Nazareth. And it's quite a lively place. It's also served over the years as a kind of meeting place. And I write about this at
length. For other writers and poets.
Exactly, for the other writers who write in Arabic who lived in Israel. And so it was never just a shop, not that there's anything wrong with just a shop, but it's always been much more than that.
He has some fascinating signs in that shop. I wonder if you could tell our listeners about that.
Well, this is, for me, where Taha actually does a pretty good job of keeping his poetic life and his shopkeeping life, not exactly separate, but these are sort of two different parts of his brain. I mean, they complement each other in lots of ways, but in the signs that he makes for his shop, these impulses meet. He loves these kind of slogans and the signage, and when Peter and Taha were invited, they've been invited many times to come read Taha's poems in the United States, and the first time we brought him, he'd never been here. He was well into his 70s, and he was fascinated by the American billboards and by the sides of the Mack trucks on the highways and what was written on them, and so he immediately adopted, I mean, he'd already been writing signs, keep making these signs for his shop, but he picked up all kinds of corporate American slogans and then kind of rejigged them so that they would be, you know, good on the wall. So that he has, for instance, a sign. He sells not just the usual trinkets, but he also has older things in his shop, like, you know, kind of antiquities almost, you know, oil lamps and coins. And so there's one sign that says, "Looking at the older makes you feel younger," which is, I guess, designed to, you know, induce the customer to buy. But he also has, I mean, and he has various other things that he's evolved. But one of my favorites is a sign that simply says, "A thing of beauty is a joy forever," John Keats. I think it's safe to say that it's the only souvenir shop in the Middle East with that on the wall.
And he also says he's a Muslim who sells Christian trinkets to Jews.
Yes.
I mean, again, that sort of shows you his humor and perhaps the sort of complex world that he lives
in. Yeah, absolutely. And it's true. He does. I've seen him do it.
So he's a very good businessman,
he's
I guess.
He's an excellent businessman.
Do you think that makes him a good poet?
That's an interesting question. Yes, I think in a way, I mean, I suppose it could also have made him a bad poet, but in Taha's own case, there's a way in which I think he sizes up every situation in which he finds himself, much as a good shopkeeper, I think, sizes up who the customer is. And there's a way in which Taha is very good at reading people and what it is that might interest them. He's not a hustler. He's not pushing things on the customers to his shop. And the whole bargaining game that goes on in a lot of Middle Eastern souvenir shops is not there. He has prices on things, and that's the price. So there's a kind of directness and honesty, and they're fair prices, so nobody really needs to bargain with him. But in that sense, I guess, and Taha also has a way of... his son, Usama, described to me how even early on when Taha was just starting his souvenir shop, he would get, for instance, a shipment of, 200 wooden rosaries. And instead of simply putting these rosaries on the shelf and selling them, Taha would say, no, they will be much better if they are a darker color. And then he would invest in a vat of stain, and he would soak them overnight so that he would have this dark rosary. That's just one example. And there's a way in which Taha is constantly reconfiguring what he finds in the world, and I think it's part of what makes him a really wonderful poet, is that he also takes certain words and situations and emotional events and plays with them and works with them. He never just picks up what he finds and uses it. It's always being somehow improved, I guess you could say.
Well, you also say he's a good storyteller and was a good storyteller even as a kid.
Oh, yeah. No, he loves to tell stories. He loves to sort of... we've often, it's really interesting, as we've traveled with Taha and as I spent many hours and months and years with him working on this book, because he really did collaborate with me in the sense of, we sat for many interviews. He will evolve a story over time. You'll sort of hear it being told once, and then you hear it again the next day, and it's not exactly the same story. It's a kind of a Bob Dylan-esque ability to never do the same thing twice, which I find incredibly wonderful and fascinating and kind of startling, because I will often, and by now I've heard certain stories many, many, many times, but it's never the exact same story.
Will you even quote Edward Said saying the characteristic mode of a Palestinian story is not a narrative, but rather broken narratives, fragmentary compositions, and self-consciously staged testimonials in which the narrative voice keeps stumbling over itself, its obligations, and its limitations?
Yeah, that's complicated. I don't actually know that I would apply that to Taha's own mm-hmm. storytelling technique. I think that's more the mode of a written Palestinian story
that's
that Said is writing about. I mean, I've never really thought about the difference. But Taha, I think his own storytelling comes out of a sort of a slightly older tradition of a kind of, I can't say that it's straightforward in the sense that he is always coming at things with this kind of his billiard cue in hand.
Right.
But there is a way in which his stories will often have kind of, three things will be repeated and in a kind of classical, almost like a fairy tale mode. So that it's not quite that. I think Said is describing a more modern right. Palestinian. I mean, Taha is modern, but when he tells these stories, he's echoing back to something older, but not without a great deal of irony and sophistication. And he's very conscious of just how modern he is, even though he has this sort of peasant past inside of him.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about Palestinian poet Taha Mohammed Ali, and our guest Adina Hoffman has written a biography of Taha Mohammed Ali. It's called My Happiness Bears No Relation to Happiness. Also with us, Peter Cole, who has translated a lot of Taha's poetry, and we'll be reading some more poems after this very short break. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The musicians will take their seats. Chief Conductor Charles Dutoit will raise his baton. And the Philadelphia Orchestra will begin the new season with Ravel's Bolero. Also, Dawn Upshaw sings songs of George Gershwin, Stephen Sondheim, and Leonard Bernstein. Tickets at 215-893-1999. Online at philorc.org. This Thursday at the Kimmel Center, opening night with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
You ask for it, we listened. WHYY-FM is trying something new. YStream, pledge-free streaming radio. Listen without membership breaks on your desktop, laptop, iPhone, or iPad. Visit WHYY.org by October 12th, make a $60 pledge, and enjoy WHYY-FM without membership breaks during our entire October fundraising campaign. For more information on YStream, WHYY's new pledge-free stream, visit WHYY.org.
ChristianaCare Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. I'm talking with Adina Hoffman today on the show about her new book. It's called My Happiness Bears No Relation to Happiness, A Poet's Life in the Palestinian Century. And she writes about Taha Muhammad Ali. He is a poet, and he also has a souvenir store in Nazareth. And we're also joined by her husband, Peter Cole. He's a poet and a translator. In fact, has translated a number of Muhammad Ali's poems, and we'll be hearing some of those translations as well. I wonder, Dean, if we could go back to the beginning and talk about Muhammad Ali, Taha Muhammad Ali's home. He was born in 1931 in this village, and I wonder if you could describe that for our listeners.
Yeah, well, the village was a fascinating place, not just in Taha's times. It's a place that historically has been important to many civilizations. Pretty much everyone who's been in the Middle East has passed through this town, from the Canaanites onward, the Greeks and the Persians. It was actually a very important Jewish town in the second and third centuries. It was called Sipori then. The Crusaders were there. It was called Sepphoris and Luciferi. There are many names. And in Taha's time, it was called Saphoria. Mm-hmm. It was the largest village in the Nazareth district of British Mandatory Palestine, which is to say there were some 4,500 people there. It was basically an agricultural place. Most people lived off their land, many orchards and gardens. And it's a place that in Taha's own life, I mean, obviously most biographers are interested in the place where their subject was born. That's just where the book, where the story starts. In Taha's case, it's even more than that, because his poetry is deeply rooted in the village. The village was destroyed in 1948, or just after the war. And the villagers, as I said, were forced to leave the village before that happened. And there's a way in which for Taha, that place is really the ground of all of his poetry, mm-hmm. both in the literal sense of his poetry is sort of populated by people who very clearly come from the village, and he writes a poetry that's full of characters. And these are people who speak the village dialect and eat the village food, and they're recognizably from Saphoria. But in a more sort of overarching sense, there's a way in which the ethos of the village and the sense of what matters in the world is what fuels Taha's poetry. It's what fuels him as a human being in the world, and in this, I think he's somehow attempting not just to preserve in a kind of pickled way, but really to kind of sustain the life of the village so that the bulldozers can do all they want and knock it over, which isn't to say that he's living just in his head and sure. in his beautiful memories. It's much more complicated than that. It's much more painful than that. He knows that the village is gone. Taha's not actually interested in real estate. He's not interested in going back to live on that particular plot of land. And he actually has one very powerful poem that's all about that, and that basically, in which he says that that this place is not, and this is not, it's dust and stone and empty space, he says. And there's a way in which I think that's critical to understand when one reads Taha on the village. He's been asked, there's a documentary film that was made in which Taha is interviewed. This is by Mohammed Bakri, a Palestinian Israeli filmmaker, and Bakri asks him, "So Taha, what will you do when you go back to your village? What will be the first thing you do?" And Taha says, "Who told you I want to go back to my village?" Yeah. That's not really what it's about for him. He talks about it in terms of Troy. As Homer's Troy is this place that has been destroyed and yet has fueled this kind of great work of the imagination. So Taha, in his own humble and ironic way, he knows he's not Homer, obviously, would like to see Sephori somehow preserved, or again, not preserved, but sustained in that sort of way.
And what exists where that town or that village was? Is there anything left today?
Yeah, well, the site of the actual, the hill where the village was is now a Jewish National Fund pine forest, which was planted in honor of Guatemalan Independence Day. There's a plaque. You can see it. There's also, there's a national park there where the trees are. And in the national park is an absolutely phenomenal set of mosaics, and the relics of the Jewish town of Tzipori are there, and you can go and visit, and it's very much worth doing. It's a beautiful site. It's a painful site for Taha and his family and friends to return to, obviously. There's also a Jewish, a moshav, a kind of a farming community, not really a farming community anymore, more like a suburban development, but that's on part of the village's land. And there actually is a small swatch of land just across the road from this moshav, which is still, it was technically a part of the village lands. It was sort of the outskirts in Taha's, during Taha's childhood, and that's actually still owned by some of the people who came from the village. Mm-hmm. There was a complicated legal suit, and they were given this property in, as a sort of compensation for the larger lands that they'd lost. And Taha, to this day, buys his vegetables from the people who have planted them there, because he says that the vegetables of Sephoria taste better than the vegetables planted anywhere else. So that's the village in a nutshell.
And I do want to actually hear him reading one of his poems, and Peter's going to translate it for us. But so he was about 17 years old.
Yeah.
Excuse me. He and his family then fled from this village to, what, Lebanon?
Yeah, that's right. He was 17, and they were forced to flee, as I said, and they ended up in various places in Lebanon, really living in the poorest circumstances that there were. They then had to sneak back. They weren't legally allowed back into the country as so-called infiltrators. This was the term that the Israeli authorities used to describe people like this who were not in the country on a particular date that had been mandated by law. And so for another very precarious 9 months or so, Taha was basically in hiding. And he was the one in his family who was most in danger, because he was sort of an able-bodied young man, whereas his mother was female and his father was lame and his brothers were too young. He was in real danger. And at one point, he was actually picked up and essentially tossed across the border, blindfolded, in Jordan, together with other young men who'd also been rounded up. And he made his way back. He wanted to be there. He couldn't be in his village anymore. The village was gone, but he wanted to at least be near it.
Let me play something, and this is actually Taha Muhammad Ali reading his poem called Revenge, and this was at the 2006 Dodge Poetry Festival, which took place in New Jersey. So let's listen to Taha Muhammad Ali reading his poem, and then we will hear Peter Cole's translation. Let's listen.
Intiqam. Ahyanan. أتمنى أن أبارز الشخص الذي قتل والدي، هدم بيتنا، شردني في بلاد الله الضيقة، فإذا قتلني أكون قد ارتحت، وإن أجهزت عليه أكون قد انتقمت، لكن إذا تبين.
Now let's hear Peter Cole's translation, Revenge.
Revenge. At times I wish I could meet in a duel the man who killed my father and raised our home, expelling me into a narrow country. And if he killed me, I'd rest at last. And if I were ready, I would take my revenge. But if it came to light when my rival appeared that he had a mother waiting for him, or a father who'd put his right hand over the heart's place in his chest whenever his son was late, even by just a quarter hour for a meeting they'd set, then I would not kill him, even if I could. Likewise, I would not murder him if it were soon made clear that he had a brother or sisters who loved him and constantly longed to see him, or if he had a wife to greet him and children who couldn't bear his absence, in whom his gifts would thrill, or if he had friends or companions, neighbors he knew, or allies from prison, or a hospital room, or classmates from his school asking about him, and sending him regards. But if he turned out to be on his own, cut off like a branch from a tree, without a mother or father, with neither a brother nor sister, wifeless, without a child, and without kin or neighbor or friends, colleagues or companions, then I'd add not a thing to his pain within that aloneness, not the torment of death, and not the sorrow of passing away. Instead, I'd be content to ignore him when I passed him by on the street, as I convinced myself that paying him no attention in itself was a kind of revenge.
Thank you for that reading. Peter Cole, reading a translation of Taha Muhammad Ali's poem, and it's called Revenge. I mean, I have to say, Adina, that just brought tears to my eyes.
Yeah, no, it does that. I've heard this poem so many times, and it still does that to me. Yeah, I mean, this poem contains so much, I don't really even know where to start. But there's a way, I think, in which so much of Taha's, I mean, there's a way in which, you know, all that he's endured and all that he's lived through, you know, for it all, it's not just a matter of exuberance. I talked about that before, but there is this kind of deep understanding of the fact that we're sort of all in this together. And obviously Taha doesn't want to be friends with the man who destroyed his home and killed his father, and that is metaphorical. I mean, Taha's father was not killed literally, but I think in some more sort of existential sense, sure, maybe Taha feels that he was.
Because he lost his home.
He lost his home, and I think his father's spirit was broken by this. But still, there is a sense that this is still another human being. I mean, I hate to paraphrase poems, but that, and I think it's also one of the powerful things about this poem is it's all very clear. You actually don't need me to explain it. And we've never seen, I mean, as I said, Taha and Peter have traveled a great deal and read everywhere, and they've read all kinds of poems, and many of Taha's poems really affect listeners deeply. This poem is in a slightly different category. I've never seen a poem that had this kind of effect on all kinds of audiences. People respond to it in a kind of just gut and very emotional way, as
well,
you're describing.
Because you go on this kind of emotional journey with him. You begin with this idea of actual revenge, and then as time goes on and the person becomes a person, I mean, yeah, the people become actual people, He changes. Yeah. I mean, and you change with
exactly
him.
Exactly. And you ride this sort of emotional and linguistic roller coaster up and down the plot. There's almost a plot to this poem, yeah, as there might be in a novel.
And the idea of someone's aloneness, the fact that they're alone, is a kind of revenge in and of itself.
Yeah.
Is the perpetrator's, you know, there are consequences to things that you do.
There's that, but there's also that even the man who's done this to you, even the man who's perpetrated these horrible crimes, you know, maybe the fact that he's alone is enough of a torment. Like, let him just be. And in fact, for my own self-preservation, I will pass him by in the street.
Yeah. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And Adina Hoffman, our guest today on Radio Times. And we're talking about Palestinian poet Taha Muhammad Ali. And she has written a biography of him. It's called My Happiness Bears No Relation to Happiness. And that is taken from one of his poems called Warning. And it's subtitled Poet's Life in the Palestinian Century. And Hoffman and her husband, Peter Cole, who's a poet and translator, both live in Jerusalem. They founded a publishing company, Ibis Editions. And Peter Cole joining us today in Radio Times to reading some of the translations of Taha Muhammad Ali's poems. And I want to open up the phones to our listeners. Any questions or comments that you might have about this poet or some of the things that you might be hearing in some of these poems, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Adina, is he a bitter man at all?
No. He's not a bitter man. I think he has some bitterness in him. I think he wouldn't be human if he didn't. But no, Taha's not bitter. And I think you hear in that poem, Revenge, all the ways in which he's not. There's a way in which he's, you know, there are so many things, so many adjectives might be applied, yeah, to Taha, but bitter is not one that I would put anywhere near the top of the list. I mean, there has to be some bitterness in the sense of bittersweetness, certainly, but he's not bitter, yeah.
He didn't really begin writing poetry till in his 40s. What got him started?
And I should say he also didn't publish his first book till he was in his 50s, so it's really quite a late start for a poet. What got him started? Well, Taha was surrounded from a very early age by poetry. I mean, growing up in this village, which on the one hand was a place where many people couldn't read, I mean, they were illiterate, and yet it was a very rich place in an oral sense. There was a lot of poetry read out loud and recited, so he kind of was surrounded by it from the get-go. But of course, not everyone who grows up in that environment grows up to be a poet, so that's not enough of an explanation. Taha had to get by and had to support his family. So for many years, he was caught up in doing that. He was also caught up in the process of educating himself. I mean, Taha only had 4 years of schooling in his village. And so for several decades, after he had moved to Nazareth and set up shop, he applied himself to simply learning what he needed. And he understood it was a kind of a plan that in order to be a writer, and he knew that he wanted to write. At first, it was fiction, actually, but he knew he would need to learn certain things first. So he learned the Arabic language in a way. I mean, Arabic is not a simple language. It's actually enormously complex. It's incredibly beautiful, but it takes real study. So he applied himself to learning the Arabic language and then began to read really widely and deeply in the classical Arabic canon and to read modern Arabic literature. He taught himself English and became a great reader of all kinds of American and English and European literature. He loves the novels of the man he calls John Steinbeck. And in fact, has read, I think, more, maybe every John Steinbeck novel that exists. But the poetry only came later. He then began to write some stories, and they're actually not very good stories, what he was writing at that stage in the 50s, as I think he himself would agree. And he wrote a bit of literary criticism, but it was really only later. And it's one of the mysteries. I mean, I say very pointedly in the book that I don't really know what first caused him to sit down and write a poem. There's a way in which I kind of go through the possibilities. Maybe it was because his father died, or maybe it was because the military government, which applied to all the Palestinian citizens of Israel, was lifted, or maybe this, maybe that. But none of them actually make sense to me as a single explanation. Maybe somehow the convergence of all these things. But when Taha did begin to write poems, they popped out as really full-blown, quite developed and sophisticated works. They weren't sort of fledgling, you know, juvenilia. And maybe he knew, he's a very wise person, maybe he knew that he should wait until he really had something serious to put down.
Is that the way he talks about it?
Not exactly. I mean, he does talk about the process of writing in his head. And in fact, before he actually sets words to paper, the poems are, in a sense, composed in his head. And that the first poems were actually written several years before the date that's written on the bottom of them. So that they were swimming around in his head somehow. But it is a bit of a mystery. And it took a long time also for Taha to gain any kind of recognition. I mean, for a long time, he published his work to very little attention at all in the Arab world, and he wasn't translated at all at that point into other languages. But very gradually, he became known, and in fact, when he was his first trip abroad was when he was in his 1950s, he was invited to go to London for an Arabic literary festival. And he met many of the leading figures in the Arab literary world. And one of them, the Iraqi Bulent al-Haydari, said, "Where have you been, Taha, all our lives? Where were you?" And I think for Taha, it was also an important experience to also encounter the rest of the Arab world, because he and many of the others, all of the others inside Israel, had been quite cut off for many years. Mm-hmm. And by now, Taha actually has quite a wide following. In the United States, certainly Copper Canyon Press published his book, So What? New and Selected Poems, a few years ago. And this book is, in poetry terms, something of almost a bestseller.
Wow.
It's really has, at the Dodge Poetry, for instance, where he read that poem Revenge, Taha is he has many admirers, let's just put it that way.
There was thunderous applause.
Yes, indeed.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I do want to have Peter read another poem or two, and we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. Excuse me. And our guest today on Radio Times, Adina Hoffman, has written a biography of Palestinian poet Taha Muhammad Ali. It's called My Happiness Bears No Relation to Happiness. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, presenting the new Lincoln MKZ. Quiet Craft Interior, Adaptive HID Headlamps, and Blind Spot Information System are all available on this luxury car. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, it's not just luxury, it's smarter than that.
Writer David Rakoff was just honored with the Thurber Prize for American Humor for his collection of essays, Half Empty, a funny book about the power of negative thinking. The book is now out in paperback. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with David Rakoff. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A research study on yelling instead catches parents spanking their kids, reigniting a debate over corporal punishment. Also a different view of war, Afghans making their films about their own lives. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Academic Urology is pleased to support WHYY at its Prostate Center in King of Prussia and 16 office locations throughout the Philadelphia region. Academic Urology provides integrated and personalized treatment for prostate cancer. AcademicUrology.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and today on the show we are talking about Palestinian poet Taha Muhammad Ali. And our guest, Adina Hoffman, has written a biography of the poet called My Happiness Bears No Relation to Happiness. I can't tell you how happy it makes me to just say that title over and over again. There's something about even the rhythm of the words. And it's subtitled A Poet's Life in the Palestinian Century. Also with us is Peter Cole. He's a poet and translator. Both of them live in Jerusalem. And Peter's been reading some of Taha Muhammad Ali's poems as we talk about his life and take calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Adina, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Abdul Hadi Fights a Superpower. Mm-hmm. This is one of his poems. And then Peter will read a translation.
Yeah. Well, this is actually one of those early poems that I just mentioned as having kind of sprung full-fledged from Taha's head. It's not his first, but it's one of the earliest ones, and I just love this poem. It's basically a poem about a figure who recurs in several of Taha's poems, Abdul Hadi, who's a sort of an Arab everyman. That's how Taha himself describes this figure. And I think the poem is fairly self-explanatory. There's one word that listeners might not know, which is labna, which is a kind of yogurt cheese that appears toward the end of the poem.
Well, you know what? Let's have Peter Cole read this poem.
Abdul Hadi fights a superpower. In his life, he neither wrote nor read. In his life, he didn't cut down a single tree, didn't slit the throat of a single calf. In his life, he did not speak of the New York Times behind its back, didn't raise his voice to a soul except in his saying, "Come in, please, by God, you can't refuse." Nevertheless, his case is hopeless, his situation desperate. His God-given rights are a grain of salt tossed into the sea. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, about his enemies, my client knows not a thing. And I can assure you, were he to encounter the entire crew of the aircraft carrier Enterprise, he'd serve them eggs, sunny side up, and labneh, fresh from the bag.
And again, another reading, Peter Cole, Abdul Hadi Fights a Superpower, a poem that by a Palestinian poet. We've been talking about Taha Muhammad Ali. And again, Adina, I mean, you know, what can you say, right?
What can you say? Well, one thing you can say is that Taha wrote this poem in, I believe it was 1973, and it's a poem that remains kind of bizarrely relevant. And that, to me, is the mark of really good poetry, that it sort of lasts beyond the circumstances of its writing. You know, it's a poem that, again, I sort of hate to paraphrase Taha's poetry, but I think it's clear that this is a poem about the people whose lives are really at stake when politicians and governments make decisions about the fate of their people. And I mean, it brings me back to something that I talk about in the book, which is the notion of what is politics at all. And that really at the heart of that word, etymologically, the root of that word, the radical root of that word, if you will, is the word for citizen in Greek. And to me, Taha's poetry epitomizes some kind of deep attention. He pays a kind of deep attention to the fate of these ordinary citizens, as, you know, like Abdulhadi, who is, I mean, he's a kind of ordinary. Taha actually described him to me when I asked, where did Abdulhadi come from, Taha? Meaning, like, where did you get the idea? But he said, oh, he comes from Seforia, my village.
Where he grew up.
Yeah, and then he proceeded to describe how he'd come up with this figure as being a cross between a peasant from his village, Seforia, and Oliver Hardy, as in Laurel and Hardy.
That's great.
All joking aside, that Oliver Hardy-esque Palestinian peasant is the one whose life is really at stake and whose culture is at stake and is in danger, I think it's safe to say, when these kind of larger decisions are made well above his head, and he doesn't know what this superpower is or what the aircraft carrier enterprise is or what the New York Times is, and yet his life is, of course, profoundly affected by those various entities.
But you know, what you just said makes me feel that the way we talk about politics, and I would include myself in this, is so barren. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is such a rich way, and obviously it's how people live that makes political discussions just so much richer, rather than the sort of good and evil, right and wrong. And that tends to be how, sadly, I think politics is discussed these days.
Yeah,
and I don't know if it's true in Israel, but certainly true in this country.
It's certainly the way, I mean, I find in this country the way Middle Eastern politics are discussed. And there tends to be a lot of pro and anti. You're either pro-Israel or you're anti, or you're pro-Palestinian or you're anti. And it gets to be very dull and flat and not true to the actual lived experience of being in the place and actually interacting with other human beings, you know, where, of course, such pros and cons just simply don't exist. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, for me, as I was writing, I was very conscious of a different dimension, which is, you know, obviously I'm Jewish, Taha is Muslim, I'm an Israeli, as is Taha, but he's also a Palestinian.
Right.
I'm also American. I mean, it's a whole mishmash of identities and whatnot. But I was very conscious of wanting to somehow capture, you know, Henry James, the novelist, has a very famous essay about the house of fiction, and I've sort of think of myself as dealing with the house of nonfiction, but he talks about the human field, the spreading scene. And that to me was a much richer way of thinking about this whole wide range of people whose lives I wanted to capture. And I should say the book isn't just about Taha. There are many other figures involved, not other writers, but also others, other peasants. There are Israelis who are here. There are good Israelis. There are bad Israelis. There are all kinds of people. There are good Arabs. There are bad Arabs. And I shouldn't even use terms like good and bad. But the point is that I wanted to really, in the richest kind of detail that I could, give a whole range of human possibility beyond this very reductive pro and con.
Well, and also in piecing together his story and the story that's sort of associated with the history with this part of the world is as you say and others have said, depending on who you talk to, you're going to get a very different either history or memory about what happens. And you talk about the importance of choosing what matters. I mean, mm-hmm. and in terms of understanding where people come from and what has happened to them, I mean, memory can be a very tricky thing.
Yeah.
So can history.
Absolutely. And I set out in this book, I felt myself to be a kind of detective as I wrote this book, and that I felt that I couldn't discard any evidence categorically, that I really needed to look at every single possible piece of evidence as if it had been there was a sort of mystery that needed to be solved, which meant that I both spent a great deal of time interviewing people, many people of all kinds, and as I listened, I absorbed a great deal, and I learned a great deal. I was also skeptical. I made sure that I never simply took someone at face value or just took their word as the truth without somehow checking it, asking many other people about the same event. So there was that dimension, which was the sort of oral dimension.
Sure.
But then I spent a lot of time in the archives searching for any kind of written evidence that I could find of life in this village, for instance, but also afterwards, some of the later periods when it came to writing about the literary life of the Arabic language writers inside Israel. I actually found incredibly helpful files in the Israel police files that are held in the Israel State Archive, because in fact police informers were sent to the various literary gatherings to take notes and rat on the people at these meetings. And in some sense, the police did the historians and the biographers a favor in preserving this material. You obviously have to read it also very skeptically, because there's a very specific political agenda. These people were being monitored, and you know, they were basically suspect. So I used those two kinds of evidence, if you will. But I spent a lot of time looking for photographs. I found all kinds of, there are interesting websites, in fact, that exist, www.palestineremembered.com, which sounds almost like, I mean, it's a bizarre combination of things, but it was actually a fascinating little anthropological keyhole into the life of the villages and the people who now, for instance, write into these guest books. Slightly kooky. I mean, there's a lot of off-the-wall stuff that gets written, but to me it was interesting that often these are people who've never set foot in the village. They're the descendants of those people who obviously still feel deeply connected to the village and express it in this very 21st century way. So my point is that I put all these different kinds of evidence together, and I hope my hope is that I was able to give a kind of a fuller version of what had gone on and not simply rely on one sort of evidence. It's very dangerous to only rely on what people tell you, or to only rely on the military records, which certain historians do. They say, I don't trust memory, people forget things, and they have political agendas. So I tried to use all of these different sources.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to hear another poem as well. Adina Hoffman, our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about what it took to write her book. It's a biography of Palestinian poet Taha Muhammad Ali. The book is called My Happiness Bears No Relation to Happiness, A Poet's Life in the Palestinian Century. And she joins us here on Radio Times, as does her husband, Peter Cole. He's a poet and a translator. And I'd love to first, Adina, have you talk about a poem called Where? And then we'll have Peter read the poem.
Okay. This is a much more recent poem of Taha's. And it's actually a different sort of poem. I think sometimes people have a tendency to think that Palestinian poets should only write about Palestinian matters, and he should only write about his village. And this is, of course, not true. He's a poet. The whole world is open to him in terms of his subject matter and his approach. And I think that's all I'll say.
Very good.
Where? Poetry hides somewhere behind the night of words, behind the clouds of hearing, across the dark of sight, and beyond the dusk of music that's hidden and revealed. But where is it concealed? And how could I possibly know, when I am barely able, by the light of day, to find my pencil?
And again, another lovely poem and a wonderful read from Peter Cole. And that's a poem called Where. Adina, I wonder just, you and your husband live in Jerusalem, and I just wonder today, I mean, is there contact between Israeli and Palestinian poets? Is there the sort of cross-cultural, you know, germination or conversations in where you live?
Not enough, I would say. Those two literary communities certainly are pretty divided. I mean, there's a lot of sort of political sympathy, I guess you could say. I mean, it tends to be that poets, you know, there is a way in which poets, Israeli Jewish poets, tend to feel sympathy and affection for certainly someone like Taha. He himself, I should say, is translated into Hebrew. He has a collection in Hebrew, which was translated by Anton Shamas, the novelist. And that's been quite a popular book in Hebrew-speaking circles. So Taha himself is able to reach across. I would be lying, though, if I said that that there was a deep understanding, certainly in the Israeli Jewish direction, in the direction of Palestinians, in the sense that most Israeli Jews, not just poets, but don't know Arabic, so there's a kind of basic linguistic barrier. I do think that when it comes to some of the Palestinian Israeli poets, there is a certain awareness of the larger cultural scene. But this tends to be the case with a so-called minority population within, I mean, not just so-called, it is a minority population, so that someone like Samih al-Qasim, who's one of the most important poets in the Arab world, who lives in Israel, he's an Israeli citizen, he's also a proud Palestinian, he reads all the time in Hebrew, and he's very involved. He's gotten a lot of his literary education through translations of world literature into Hebrew, so he's quite open to it. On the other hand, you know, we've been at various gatherings where there are Palestinian and Israeli poets, and the fact is there's a kind of basic sympathy, but when you get into the sort of harder stuff of really reading the poetry of the people on the so-called other side and really trying to understand it, I don't think that there's that deep an understanding. I mean, maybe that's ungenerous of me, but I felt it was critical for me in writing this book to really throw myself headlong into Arabic as a language. I didn't feel that I could write the biography of a writer whose language I didn't know. And that was a critical thing for me to do, and I feel that I know much more about that, about Taha's world through the language. And it's always seemed odd to me that poets wouldn't want to do something similar, in the sense that they come at the world with their language and without the tool of, it's not just a tool, it's a whole way of being. It's much harder. But as I say, there is affection and there is some possibility there, I suppose.
We're almost out of time here, but what does Taha Muhammad Ali think of the book that you've written about him?
Well, he's obviously very pleased that this book exists and that he has all these pictures of himself on the front of it. Taha is, he also, as I said before, he worked with me very hard on this book. So he, not only did I have his blessing, but I really had his help, and it would have been impossible to write the book without him. Taha is not in the greatest physical shape right now. He's fairly weak.
How old is he now then?
He's 78. He hasn't read the book cover to cover. It's a big book in a foreign language for him. He's looked at all the pictures. He has had a friend read several passages out loud to him. But just before I came to the States, I'm on a book tour now, and just before I left, I called him to say, Taha, I'm going to America. I'm going to be talking about your poetry and your life, and I just want you to know. And he said, very good. I want to order 40 copies of the book. And then he said, how much? And then he proceeded to bargain me down. So I now have to shell out a certain amount of money. So I guess he's pleased if he wants to give the book to his friends.
Well, and it shows what a good businessman slash poet that he is.
Exactly.
Well, I'd love to have you read some more poems, but unfortunately we are out of time, and I thank you, both of you, actually. Adina Hoffman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having us
today on Radio Times. It's been a great pleasure. And Peter Cole, thank you very much for those readings as well. And again, our guests have been talking about Palestinian poet Taha Muhammad Ali, and Adina Hoffman's book about him is titled My Happiness Bears No Relation to Happiness, published by Yale University Press. I should add that our guests both live in Jerusalem and founded a publishing company called Ibis Editions, and they both joining us today on Radio Times. And Peter's been reading from a collection of poems and the book called So What? These are the poems of Taha Muhammad Ali. And I'm assuming, Peter, you translated the poems that are in here as well. And again, thank you very much. It's wonderful to hear poetry, I do have to say. Scotty Williams, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Patty Leswing, Devorah Lissick, and Susan Greenbaum produce the program. I'm Artie Moscowane. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Leave us an email. Tell us what you think of the program. I'm Artie Moscowane, and you're listening to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.